on the trail of an assassin.
Actually, I think that in a weird way, Hoover's well-publicized hatred of King intensified the manhunt, because I think that nothing was more important to Hoover than the reputation of the FBI. And I think he feared that people were going to say, well, maybe he did it.
That's Hampton Sides. We talked to him about Hellhound on His Trail, the stalking of Martin Luther King Jr., and the international hunt for his assassin. And Apocalypse Then?
The boy is out trying to get the dog, and the first bombs hit in Kansas City, and he looks at the blast, and it blinds him. And, I saw this, and I was thinking about the movie, and realized that that character, the boy, was really a perfect metaphor for me.
That's Stephen Church. He tells us about The Day After the Day After. It's a memoir about growing up in the shadow of apocalyptic visions, including the making of the TV movie The Day After in his hometown of Lawrence, Kansas. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When James Earl Ray was arrested for the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., it was all too easy for most white Americans to dismiss him as racist white trash that had nothing to do with the moderate mainstream. But the route that Ray traversed from a childhood steeped in violence and poverty to the day he gunned King down was one that was paved as much by society as by the complex currents of his own individual life and psyche. In his new book, my guest Hampton Sides traces Ray's journey as an assassin in parallel with King's evolution from a civil rights leader to an advocate for an America of greater opportunity for all. It was a vision bent on healing the very forces that made a James Earl Ray possible, the forces of violence and poverty. The book is Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. The book is part police procedural, part psychological analysis, and part social critique. It's also a spellbinding examination of the lives of the two men, Martin Luther King Jr. and James Earl Ray, as they approached each other on their fateful trajectory. Hampton Sides is also the author of Ghost Soldiers and Blood and Thunder, among other works. I met with him in the offices of Random House, the publisher of Hellhound on His Trail. I started out by asking Sides what got him onto the trail of this book.
I grew up in Memphis, and born and raised, and this was the largest thing, the most controversial thing that's happened in Memphis's history, the death of Martin Luther King. It sent shockwaves out all over the world, all over the country, but Memphis has had to sort of live with the infamy of the King assassination since April 4th, 1968. So I wanted to, although I don't live in Memphis anymore, I wanted to go back to my hometown and kind of deconstruct what had happened, what brought King to Memphis, the confluence of forces that were swirling around Memphis in that spring of 68.
Tell us a little bit about Memphis. You say that it was really at the fault line, the racial fault line of America. What do you mean by that?
Well, it was the capital of the Mississippi Delta, and the Delta was sort of the last iteration of the Southern planter society way of life. In the Civil War, just before the Civil War, in the years leading up to the Civil War, as they were beginning to finally tear down all the hardwood forests along the Mississippi River, discovering this just incredibly fertile alluvial soil along the Delta, planters from Virginia and North Carolina and eastern states of the South moved west to kind of try it one last time. And so it's sort of like the last hurrah of that kind of way of life. So the Mississippi Delta was, of course, is full of cotton plantations, and the big city nearby was Memphis. And as mechanization came to the cotton plantations, large numbers of sharecroppers were forced off the fields into cities like Memphis, where they really had no skills. And many of them went to work in jobs like the sanitation department, being garbage men. And this whole story of Martin Luther King's coming to Memphis centers on the garbage workers. Garbage workers went on strike after there was a hideous accident that took place in one of these hydraulic trucks.
The accident killed two sanitation workers who were drawn into the truck's garbage grinding mechanism when it malfunctioned. Their wages were so low that their families didn't even have the wherewithal to bury them.
This kind of is what ignited the strike in February of 68 that led to Martin Luther King's coming to Memphis to represent the garbage workers in this sort of standoff that had been going on for weeks.
Now, this came at a very particular point, a turning point in some ways in Martin Luther King's own evolution as a leader, as a civil rights leader, going beyond civil rights to economic rights. And say a little bit about this. What was going on with Martin Luther King? What was he planning?
Well, he had kind of evolved from simple civil rights to this idea of economic justice, which was a much more radical, much more controversial idea. He wanted to go to Washington with a large number of poor people and what he was calling the Poor People's Campaign. He was going to build this enormous shanty town on the mall at the feet of Capitol Hill to kind of lay the grievances at the feet of government. And it wasn't meant to be just African-Americans, but poor people from all backgrounds all over the country. Needless to say, this was considered to be a very controversial thing to do this. And a lot of his advisors and old allies were telling him, you know, this is not a very good thing to do now, and you know, with the Vietnam War and with the presidential election of 68. But he thought that this was imperative, you know, to kind of confront the problem of systemic multi-generational poverty, to kind of get back to some of the early days of LBJ's Great Society programs that had kind of been left by the wayside in the wake of the Vietnam War. Basically, we were sending all our dollars overseas to fight in the jungles of Vietnam instead of addressing these problems, which were manifesting themselves in these horrible riots that we'd been seeing at Watts and Newark and Detroit and elsewhere. So King thought this was kind of the last possibility for nonviolence, that if we didn't do something like this, there were going to be more riots, even bigger riots in the streets all over America. And this was what he was working on when he got this phone call to come to Memphis to represent the garbage workers. He thought, well, this is perfect. This is kind of like the local expression of what he was trying to do in Washington, because the garbage men were the men farthest down. I mean, they were the lowest rung of the economic ladder, and they weren't asking for the moon. They were just, you know, asking for some very basic grievance procedures and a slight raise in their salary and showers. Basically, there was no showers. These guys were just filthy dirty every day and didn't have any place to wash off, and some benefits and the right to organize, the right to form a union. So he took this call. Instead of sort of making the right turn into Washington, he made this left turn into Memphis.
And meanwhile, now there's the whole other thread of the story. You have this alternation of exploration of the simultaneous lives of these two main characters, Martin Luther King and James Earl Ray, although you don't name him as James Earl Ray till the very end of the book. Tell us what his name is, and who was he, and what was he doing shadowing Martin Luther King?
Well, James Earl Ray went by a variety of aliases over his long criminal career, some 39 aliases. In this book, I think he goes by something like six or seven, including Eric Galt, Harvey Lohmeyer, Paul Bridgman, Ramon Snead, a couple of others. I was kind of exploring this very incoherent identity that he had. He had so many names and so many aliases, so many identities that he inhabited, that I think he was genuinely confused at times about, you know, who he was and, you know, which identity he was playing today, kind of thing. I mean, at times I even wondered whether he might have had sort of a multiple personality disorder. So I wanted to take his various aliases at face value. In other words, when he calls himself Galt, I call him Galt, because all the people around him that had to deal with him thought he was Galt. And what I was really trying to do with that is have the reader learn that he is James Earl Ray at the point in the story when the FBI learned, and at the point in the story when the nation learned that that was what his name was. A lot of people thought, well, God, why did it take the FBI so long to catch this James Earl Ray? They knew who he was. They had fingerprints, you know. Well, no. For almost 3 weeks, they didn't know who they were looking for. They didn't find out his real name until he had already escaped to Canada and was almost on his way to London. So that's an important part in terms of understanding the level of difficulty of finding this guy.
So James Earl Ray, I mean, he is a fascinating character in this book. I almost wondered what it was like for you to begin to discover who he was. I mean, you just said yourself that he was confused about who he was. Certainly it must have been confusing for you. Was there a moment where you felt that you really grasped him?
He is so murky. He is so complicated. And just when you think you have him figured out, he's moved on to another name and another location, another story. His stories always evolve. They're always changing. They're full of lies, but there's always truth embedded in the lies. And sifting through all that stuff is exasperating. It's frustrating. It was like this enormous game that he played with history and with any kind of authority, whether it be, you know, a shrink or a doctor, a lawyer, a warden. And also with writers, anyone who had to interview him. It was like this big cat and mouse game that, and I think he enjoyed playing. He enjoyed sending out these multiple conflicting signals. I often describe him as a squid who, as you approach him, squirts out this big ink cloud, and you can't see him in there. You don't know where he is, or if he's there anymore at all, or was he lying? Is he telling the truth? What's his story? He mumbled a lot. He changed his alibis. He, you know, constantly evolved and kept up this game that I'm talking about, really, until the day he died.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Hampton Sides about his book Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. And yet, ironically, you say, or you ascribe to him, the motivation to be known, to be seen, to become notorious.
You know, it's a weird combination of wanting anonymity and wanting notoriety. He developed a persona that was anonymous. It was very generic. He tried to be in the shadows. He tried to be invisible. He said he wanted to have a face that no one could remember. And at the same time, he did these things, especially this one thing, that was guaranteed to give him notoriety for the rest of American history. And you could see that in his love for the chase, too. He didn't want to get caught, but he always seemed to leave some clue behind that was guaranteed to get him caught so that he'd go back to jail and have to spring from prison again and thus initiate another bigger chase. He seemed to love the chase. That seemed to be a big part of his personality. But a little of a just sort of nuts and bolts background about him. He was born in Alton, Illinois. He lived in a succession of impoverished towns along the Mississippi River Valley in Missouri and Illinois. He was a career criminal, mostly, you know, stick-up. He was a stick-up artist and, you know, armed robbery and cashing money orders. And he basically was in and out of jail his whole life. And then he finally found himself in the Missouri State Penitentiary in Jefferson City, where he endeavored to escape. And he finally did escape in a bread box from the prison bakery that was bound for the Honor Farm, where, you know, some of the less dangerous criminals were working. He hopped out of this bread box and ran off down the railroad tracks and made his escape into history. And so he was a fugitive already for about a year before the assassination. And he found his way to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, and then finally to Los Angeles, where he was up to all kinds of odd things, like he was taking dancing lessons. He graduated from a bartending school. He went to a number of shrinks and hypnotists. He also got a nose job just 1 month before the assassination. He was taking a locksmithing correspondence course. He was aspiring to be a porn director. He was up to all kinds of stuff and was kind of living a life that really showed to me that he was trying on different lifestyles, and he was desperate, I think, to find something to make something stick. He was trying to find some sort of meaning, some sort of happiness. And the thing that seemed to galvanize him, though, through all these eclectic endeavors of his was the George Wallace for President campaign of 1968. Wallace really spoke to him and moved him, and he volunteered for the organization and went around trying to get signatures on the ballot for him. And buttonholing strangers, trying to get them to go down to the Wallace office and lend their hand to the cause. So, you know, this was not a joiner. James Earl Ray always, as I said earlier, kind of lived in the shadows, but he joined, you know, he hitched his wagon to this particular cause. And I think he actually believed that Wallace could be elected president. He seemed to be hopeful that this could actually happen and it would, you know, change history.
So he was motivated primarily, it seems, by his hatred for black people.
I don't want to say primarily. It's hard to say for sure anything with Ray's personality, but he was a racist. He talked in prison about Martin Luther King and talked at one point about having heard something about bounties that were out there on King's head killing King could be his retirement plan, and he considered himself an aficionado of the JFK assassination and liked to talk about the mistakes that Oswald had made and you know, maybe he would be smarter or something like that with King. He also had gravitated toward the John Birch Society and had written a number of letters to them. He had inquired about immigrating to the breakaway racist state of Rhodesia, thinking, well, they would embrace him. And, you know, he seemed to like what Ian Smith was up to down there and had these ideas of becoming a mercenary soldier. So, yeah, racism was certainly a part of his – it's very complicated kind of cluster of motivations. He was also within the family lore – Ray was supposedly the smart one. James was supposedly the smart one, the ambitious one, the one that was going to do big things. And this need for recognition that we talked about, the need for somebody to just notice him. And then I think also you have to say that he had some history of mental illness. Different prison shrinks had expressed their worries about him. They didn't exactly know what was wrong with him, but he had obsessive compulsive disorders and was a hypochondriac and was constantly worried about his safety. And all of this accentuated very much by long-term use of amphetamines. So, you know, kind of put all these little sub-motivations into a blender and hit puree or something, and maybe whatever it is that's left in that blender is kind of the stew of his personality that would be capable of a crime like this.
Of course, the big question, and I think it's one that I felt was sub rosa in your book, but I think you certainly hint at it. You hint at the questions, not at the answers, and that is whether he had any accomplices or even was part of a conspiracy. I guess I wonder, where did you come down on this after all that? I know you didn't want to make a definitive statement. I think the King family does feel that Martin Luther King was a victim of a conspiracy, and I know there are other writers working on this. Where do you come down?
Well, I probably started this project believing in some level of conspiracy because I grew up in Memphis and I heard about that all the time. It's just you hear anything enough times, you start to believe it, that perhaps he was a patsy or he was framed or at the very least that he was part of a conspiracy. But as I got deeper into the story, I found that the evidence against him was overwhelming in terms of, you know, he bought the scope. He bought the ammunition. He bought the ammo. He bought the binoculars. He checked into that place like several hours before the assassination, and he left 1 minute after the assassination in the getaway car that everyone saw on South Main in Memphis. And he admitted to every one of those things. And he admitted to killing King, too. I mean, it's important to recognize that he did plea bargain and had to confess to some 50 points of fact. And the evidence against him was so overwhelming that his lawyer urged him to plea bargain or face the electric chair. 3 days later, however, he recanted parts, not all, but parts of his testimony. He said, all of that's true, all about buying the weapon, the scope and all that. And I wasn't in that flop house. And yes, I bought those binoculars a few hours before. And I did. That was my car. You know, all of those points. He just said that this guy named Raul pulled the trigger. But the problem with Raul for me is that and I know he's mystified and fascinated and enchanted a lot of people, including members of the King family, as you say, and the inner circle. The problem with Raul is, you know, no one's ever seen this guy. No one knows his last name. No one knows what he looks like. Ray was never although his life, in a way, depended on it, was never able to describe him in any kind of accurate way. But he said that Raoul sort of dictated his movements for a whole year. Here's this cagey, stir-wise character, James Earl Ray, doesn't trust anybody, but we're asked to believe that he trusted this guy, Raoul, who he didn't even know, for a whole year to go buy a weapon, go buy scope, go to Memphis, you know, do all these things, almost like he was a Manchurian candidate with a chip in his head or something. And so I just find the whole Raoul story very implausible and not credible. And I think that he was another alias. And just as a guy who spent his entire criminal career creating aliases, and I just think this was another one. Or perhaps it was like his imaginary friend or something.
Could Raoul, however, be a red herring? Because it does seem that he had some help in escaping. There was this whole, escaping from prison, but also then in his escape after the assassination, there was this mysterious car chase.
Mm-hmm. Well, having said all that about conspiracy, I have to say, in a way, I too am a conspiracist. I believe that he had help. I think that's the definition of a conspiracy. More than one person working in a common goal like this, working towards a crime. I think when we say conspiracy, there's just this idea that it has to be this, you know, shadowy, sophisticated, government-run thing with, a lot of the conspiracy theories that are out there involve, you know, the FBI, the CIA, the mafia, the White House, the Memphis Police Department, the Memphis Fire Department, all these different groups working somehow miraculously. These groups that can never work together in real life are working beautifully in sync to kill Martin Luther King or JFK or RFK or whoever you might be talking about. A conspiracy can just be a crude group of three, four, or five guys. And I think that's much more what I sense was going on in this story. I didn't find the evidence to prove the identities of any of these other people who might have been helping him. So I don't go into speculating about it other than to say that, yes, along the trail there are many times when we don't really know what Ray is doing. For example, he goes to New Orleans shortly before the assassination and meets with somebody. And of course, whenever you say New Orleans, it's automatically JFK, conspiracy, mafia. I don't necessarily think that. I just think he had some criminal associate there. And all the activities that were going on in Los Angeles, he seems to be meeting with people. And when he's in Toronto gathering aliases, he seems to have some help in doing that. Obviously, he needed money for all these fugitive travels. And perhaps someone was giving him money along the line. Perhaps there was a bounty that he might have known about that he connected with and maybe got a down payment. I say maybe because there's no hard and fast evidence of this. It's just that there's lots of gaps in the record, and there's instead of a straight line, it's a dotted line. There's all these little things that we just don't know what was going on. So I consider myself a conspiracist. I know that he but this is a crude and small conspiracy. I know that he had some dealings with his brothers. He talks throughout his wanderings about a brother. Like when he bought the gun, he actually took it back and he said, "My brother said this is the wrong gun. I got the wrong gun. We're going hunting up in Wisconsin where the bucks are really big. We need a bigger gun." And three, four, five, six, maybe even a dozen times he mentions brothers, and he had these two brothers, Jerry and John. Perhaps they aided and abetted in various ways. So that's the long-winded answer to your question, is that yes, I think he had some help along the way.
And tell us about this bizarre, it seems like almost a decoy car chase.
Right. Well, the conspiracy theorists point to that as a prime example that this had to have been this, sophisticated conspiracy. But there was, while Ray was leaving Memphis, heading towards Atlanta to ditch his car and pick up some things, there was over the airwaves a hoax car chase. There was some kid who was on a CB radio saying he was chasing a white Mustang, because it had been reported over the police radios that they were looking for a white Mustang. He said he was chasing this white Mustang, and the white Mustang was going like 90 miles an hour down Summer Avenue, which is a completely different direction from the actual direction that Ray was heading in, and that this guy was shooting at him, and you know, there was all this kind of drama. But it turned out to be a complete hoax. There was no chase. No one saw this chase. They found out that the signal strength on the radio transmission was not getting weaker as they left the city limits, so it was clear they were stationary. And whoever caused this, whoever was behind this, and the FBI thought they identified the probable culprit. He was a 16-year-old CB nut. You know, this was kind of the early days of the CB radio craze. But whatever the case, it did have the effect of helping aid Ray's escape from Memphis, because while he was going in that direction, the Memphis police were all focused on Summer Avenue, this other location in town. Understandably would kind of produce a lot of skepticism, a lot of questions. There's a lot of points along the story like this where things like this happen. But I mean, you know, I think it's also just as possible that this was just a hoax perpetrated by a teenager who heard this and was just in the heat of the moment. And that's pretty much what the FBI decided had happened. That's a good question. And there's a lot of little places like this. And I don't claim to have all the answers to it. I actually kind of have a little fun with that sequence because just the extent to which it really threw the Memphis police off.
The book is Hellhound on His Trail, and we're talking with Hampton Sides. It's about the last months of Martin Luther King's life, his assassination, and about his assassin, James Earl Ray. Now, you mentioned the FBI as being one target of those who think that there was a conspiracy against King. They had a lot of good reason to suspect that. Talk about the role of the FBI, how they themselves saw King, and then how they went after solving the assassination.
Well, the FBI, without question, had been doing everything it could to hound King and smear him and sabotage him. J. Edgar Hoover hated King for all kinds of reasons and had decided he was a commie and a subversive, and he was shocked and at the same time titillated by the stories about King's extracurricular activities. Indiscretions. You know, these guys really, the field agents pursued King really to try to prove that he was a communist, and they didn't. They weren't able to prove that because King was not a communist. But what they found was he did have a weakness for women. Those stories were true. So then Hoover tried to capitalize on those stories by putting together a kind of a greatest hits tapes of all the hotel rooms and the various garbled moans and points of ecstasy that you can. I mean, apparently, this tape you really understand what was going on, but it was sent in a package that Coretta King herself opened first, with a note urging King essentially to commit suicide or risk having this all be exposed. I mean, that's the level that the FBI had descended to. In terms of trying to ruin him and humiliate him. So, of course, yes, it's absolutely understandable that a lot of conspiracy people would say, well, the FBI was willing to go that far, then maybe they would be willing to have King assassinated. But as I got into the files, the Merkin files, they're called, I became convinced that the FBI, once this assassination happened, there was like a level of desperation in the memos coming out of Washington, that they, you know, the pressure that they were under to solve this case and to, there's like some 3,000 agents working on it, turning over every stone and pursuing every lead. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of false leads that they're getting. It's the largest manhunt in American history in terms of man hours. I think that the FBI was not particularly good at smearing and sabotaging and doing these things. They failed really in the end in that job. But once their job shifted to what it was they're actually supposed to be doing, which is solving a crime, they did a magnificent job. And that's really the last third of the book is really about the police work. It becomes kind of the story of just kind of the sheer shoe leather that was expended in solving this case. And, you know, in that sense, it was one of the FBI's finest hours.
Were you surprised?
I was completely surprised. I mean, I certainly had a bias against the FBI going into this. I figured, well, they were up to all kinds of shady business, and probably they didn't want to find King's killer. Probably they were not particularly. You know, I just figured they were dragging their feet on this thing. But quite the contrary. Actually, I think that in a weird way, Hoover's well-publicized hatred of King intensified the manhunt. Because I think that nothing was more important to Hoover than the reputation of the FBI. And I think he feared that people were going to say, well, maybe he did it. And so paradoxically, I think it's kind of like, the hatred made the manhunt more desperate.
Hamptonside's new book is Hellhound on His Trail. Stay tuned for more after the break.
Down on my burden, down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna lay down my burden, down by the riverside. Today, more, no more.
We're talking with Hampton Sides about his book, Hellhound on His Trail. It's about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and the hunt for his assassin, James Earl Ray. In the book, Sides delves into the personalities of his two protagonists, going behind the myth to reveal the men in all their human complexity. Now, I've asked you about the character of James Earl Ray. You also really go into King himself, and you've just referenced his extramarital affairs. I think this is a side of King. You know, we may have heard a little bit about it, but very few people really, really know much about it. And of course, he's become so idolized for very good reasons. I mean, he also, clearly, his greatness shines through in the book. How did you feel as you delved into some of these more nuanced parts of his character?
Well, certainly not as well known, but you know, the stories have been out there. I certainly don't dwell on it, but I do talk a little bit about one liaison that he had the night before he was killed in Memphis. There was a state senator from Kentucky named Georgia Davis who came down to be with him, and I met with her. I interviewed her. I read her book. I read transcripts of interviews with her. Abernathy talks about her in his own memoirs. There's no question that she was there, and everyone in the inner circle knew about her. She's a delightful lady and a good person, but there she was. It's sort of an inconvenient fact, and I didn't really want to dwell on other mistresses that he had, but I figured that it was really important for me to talk about her because she was there that night, and she was there all that day, April 4th, and she was so caught up in it when it happened that she found herself wanting to get into the ambulance, almost like, she just wanted to be with them. And, of course, members of the inner circle had to say, Georgia, I don't think you want to do that. That's really not – that's not too good. That's not too smart. So she was part of the scene, and I definitely went into describing her. But, it's so different from something like Kennedy. You know, there's a lot of stories about Kennedy's indiscretions, and he was taking huge and outrageous risks and having liaisons with perfect strangers, and and here he is, the president of the United States. My understanding of King's mistresses were they tend to be long term. Relationships with women that he knew well, and he had a number of them, and they were meaningful. And they were substantial people, so the quality of his indiscretions was very different from someone like Kennedy.
And in fact, Georgia almost apologized to Coretta King.
Yes, she came to Atlanta where everyone was mourning and getting ready for the funeral, and. And she did say she was sorry to Coretta, and not sure what she was saying sorry for. Sorry for the death or sorry for their affair. But that's one of the more awkward passages in the book, actually. It's kind of hard to read to see those two ladies in the same place in that situation.
And Coretta King, finally, you make the point that in their marriage, she really took a step back, and it wasn't something that she was particularly happy about. It almost seems as if Martin Luther King's death, which was something that she had been expecting, as he had for a long time, the assassination, liberated a part of her to become great as well.
Martin Luther King was fairly conservative and traditional on the question of the role of women in the household. He wanted Coretta there with the kids, kind of thing. And she came out on some of his marches, but she was kind of restrained a little bit. And she had enormous talents. She was a beautiful singer and a great speaker and a great presence. And it was really only after King died that she was able to really show that side of herself. And maybe the best example of it was just a few days after he died, she came to Memphis to lead the march that he obviously could not lead. And she just was magnificent. You know, she played the part. She lived the part. She gave a great speech. She was dignified. She was composed and regal. And it was just an extraordinary piece of political theater. I mean, it was genuine, and it was powerful. And, you know, everyone was crying, and she was the only one who wasn't crying. She somehow kept it together during that amazing march where there was no violence, there was no shouting, there was nothing but the sound of leather on pavement as they marched through the streets of Memphis to City Hall. So, yeah, I mean, she really emerged from that as the as the kind of the matriarch of the civil rights movement that she had always wanted to be.
Well, Hampton Sides, your terrific book is Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. Thanks so much for talking with us.
It's great being here. Thank you.
In addition to Hellhound on His Trail, Hampton Sides is the author of Blood and Thunder and Ghost Soldiers. He's also an editor of Outside Magazine. Next up, we talk with Stephen Church about his memoir, The Day After, The Day After. As a child growing up during the Reagan era in Lawrence, Kansas, Stephen Church had febrile seizures where he would be visited by hallucinatory visions of the apocalypse. He became obsessed with the end of the world. Then, his vision seemed to be borne out when his hometown became the stage set for the filming of the apocalyptic TV movie, The Day After. Church's memoir, The Day After, The Day After, gives the lie to idyllic notions of heartland America. We learn about bloody Kansas and F5 tornadoes, as well as the breakup of Church's family. But the book is hung on the frame of the time when nuclear war did come to Lawrence, Kansas.
It did, sort of, at least a fake one. Even though I was aware of nuclear war and was certainly afraid of it, it was also something of an abstraction. So when The Day After came to town, it was rather disturbing in many ways, partly because of the nature of the film itself. They called it faction at the time and said that it was a realistic portrayal of life after the apocalypse.
In The Day After, The Day After, Church writes about other catastrophes that touched his family, like the massive F5 tornado that demolished his father's hometown of Greensburg, Kansas.
Yeah, it was on May 4th of 2007, and it was probably a mile to a mile and a half wide, and actually moving pretty slow, but on the ground, and it plowed into Greensburg and took about a half an hour to move through town. And by the time it left, about 95% of the town was just completely gone. They say that the wind speeds were in upwards of 260 to possibly 280 miles per hour, which is, a good 100 miles per hour greater than a Category 5 hurricane. So it actually makes the term apocalyptic seem like an abstraction completely. And to see that, even 6 weeks later when I went, I mean, it just looked like somebody had taken the entire town and just run it through a wood chipper. And this is a place, of course, that I spent a lot of time in and grew up. It was, as I say in the book, the closest thing probably to an ancestral home that I had. And it was, at a time when I was still trying to figure out what this book was about. I've been trying to write this for quite some time and get my head around it. And then this happens, and at the time, I think I was trying to keep my dad out of the book. I thought, oh, I'm not going to write another book about dad. He was a big part of my first one. And then, sure enough, this happens. And I decided to go home with my dad about 6 weeks after the storm to kind of help do a final cleanup of my aunt's house before it was to be torn down. So, it was one of those things as a writer that sort of thrusts itself into your life and into the book. And then, of course, completely changed how the book was moving and what it meant, really. Changed kind of what apocalypse meant to me.
How was that? How did it change that?
Well, I think one of the troubles I was having with the book is that it was still, in many ways, an abstraction, even though I was writing about this movie, which was very real to me, and I always enjoy writing about film and pop culture and stuff. I think on some level was having a problem finding the emotional connections to apocalypse. I mean, divorce is part of the book, and there's a memoir of that, but that was a part of my life, and it was painful, but, it wasn't.
Your parents divorced.
Yeah, and it's something a lot of kids went through at the time, and I was really more interested in that, the story of the divorce as being something that was part of that age. And then I think the tornado, when it happened, it sort of grounded me and gave me these kind of emotional touchstones that I could think about. And, it made the book, in a lot of ways about home. I think it was always about that, I guess, but it somehow refocused the book, I think, on what that meant to go home and what it meant to lose home and lose those places that you think of as, that you identify with as home.
The book really does explore the idea of a shared consciousness of apocalypse, the larger view.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is around this film that we've mentioned, The Day After. Talk a little bit about what it was like to have that movie go on. I mean, how did it change the way you thought about things and the people around you? How did it change the way they thought about a nuclear apocalypse?
To me, it was extremely bizarre as a kid because it was something that a lot of people saw as kind of fun. I mean, it was kind of a lark to have these movie crews in town. And at the time that they were filming, we didn't know kind of all the details of the story, the full implications of what was happening. We knew that they were filming a movie about, the day after an apocalypse, and they were doing stuff to the town, like, trashing the streets. And on some level, I think, there was a sort of celebration of it. It's a spectacle. No, nothing like that had ever happened, to us before. But, I first kept thinking, yeah, but it's about the end of the world. A lot of people didn't focus on that, And one of the things, of course, I learned in the book is that people's reactions to it were varied. I mean, I had friends who were in the movie, and their memories of it are mostly like, oh, that was fun. I got to go in the makeup trailer and they put fake scars on me and it was awesome. And then I have, other people who tell me they still can't watch the movie to this day, and that it just totally scared the hell out of them, much like it did me. I mean, at the time when the movie actually aired, as I mentioned in the book, I couldn't watch it. At one point I had to leave. And it was only later that I could go back and watch it. And some of it is that, I'm looking at the screen and seeing friends of mine, kids who I played Little League baseball with, guys that I later, went to school with, getting vaporized on the screen or have a really important role in the movie. And it was very, even more real, obviously, for us in Lawrence, that they're filming at scenes in Allen Fieldhouse where I've spent, many, 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 many hours, and on campus where I grew up and other places. And so all the settings are the same. All the settings are real and familiar. And even the people in it are, and it was, uh, It feels actually, still today, honestly, when I watch it, it's this odd thing where it feels like a documentary. And some of that is the technique of the film. And then obviously some of it is just the setting, the actors, and that the way that it's done. And it was very, very bizarre for me. Some people, obviously, like the mayor and other folks, think it was really, really important for the town. And it was like...
He actually invited, was it Reagan and Gorbachev to come together to the town to have a conversation?
Yeah, he publicly said, you know, and of course Lawrence was in the news a lot, and he was quoted as inviting them to come to town and have a summit and sit down and talk. And I think the quote was as fathers and as men. And he too was really struck, especially by a particular scene in the film where Ellen Anthony, who was a local girl, says to her father, you know, there isn't going to be a war, is there, Daddy? And at that point, it's already begun, and you know, everybody sort of knows that. And he focused on that a lot. He made that proposal. He actually got to go to the Soviet Union, and in some ways, they embraced him more than the U.S. government did, which was kind of interesting. They both, you know, issued statements on his request that they meet, sort of politely declining. But you know, as a kid, that seemed kind of cool to me. I mean, that was one of the things in the experience that I thought, wow, if Lawrence could do that, I mean, if Lawrence could have that impact and actually reach people in that way, you know, maybe it wasn't the worst thing that happened to our town.
And you actually say that you think that the movie did have a profound impact on Reagan, on President Reagan.
Yeah. Yeah, which is something that, you know, I didn't, again, I learned in researching the book and writing it, and I'd heard about this. I'd heard people talk about this, and in fact, it was when the biography Dutch came out, and there was mention in there about him being greatly depressed after seeing the film. And when I talked with Nicholas Meyer about it, I got even more about that story and realized that...
And he's the director of the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the director, and he... He believes that wholeheartedly. Not only that it affected Reagan, but that it changed his thinking about nuclear buildup and his thinking towards possible treaties, and you know, which is kind of a, you know, it's sort of crazy. Honestly, when I heard that first, I thought, no way! Like that movie was it. Not really very good, and that can't be true. But the more and more I talk to him, and the more kind of anecdotal evidence he presented, and the more I've heard, it not only seems possible, but likely that this movie really did change the way that Reagan was thinking about things.
Why do you think that?
Well, I think part of it is just because of who Reagan was, because he was, you know, for all of his problems, he wasn't an idiot, and you know, he understood the power of film, obviously, and I think he probably saw something in the movie. I mean, this is what Meyer believes, and this, I think, honestly, this is what I believe now, that he saw something in the film that he knew that it was going to affect people, and it was going to have this, it was really going to stay with people, and it, of course, has. You know, Meyer kind of always believed that this movie would have the kind of lingering effect that it does. I mean, when I told him that the movie messed with me, not that he was happy, but he was, to him, that meant that he had done, you know, that the movie had done what he intended. And, you know, he had, of course, some stories, as I mentioned in the book, about David Gergen and other people saying, you know, what are we going to do about this movie? We have to do something. And that I think, is just kind of, I found that just totally fascinating, that level of the story. And then to hear Meyer tell it, and he's clearly just completely convinced of it, and he, quite frankly, just won me over, and I think he's probably right. I mean, I think Reagan probably saw this film and began to think a little differently about policy, which that's kind of amazing, I think.
Yeah, and he actually, he did the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty.
Yeah.
Was proposed by him, which was, I guess, the first, is that right, the first treaty to begin to limit the nuclear...
Yeah, I believe that was the first one, and I think that's the one that afterward somebody had called Meyer and said to him specifically, you know, don't think your movie didn't have something to do with this.
Hmm. We're talking with Stephen Church about his memoir, The Day After the Day After, My Atomic Angst. He grew up in Lawrence, Kansas in the 1970s and 80s, obsessed by fantasies of nuclear meltdown, genetic mutation, and post-apocalyptic survival. The movie about nuclear apocalypse, The Day After, was filmed in Lawrence, Kansas, while he was growing up there. Now, you also have this line of fiction in this memoir, the Dahlberg Variation.
Yeah.
Tell us about it, and why did you do that?
You know, initially, I think the first things that I had that were in that area were a series of fake letters that I had imagined Danny Dahlberg writing to me. And
who's he?
Danny Dahlberg is a character in the movie. He is the little boy. He's the son of the farm family. The father's played by John Cullum. And he is outside, and he's trying to get the family dog. It's a theme that echoes in the Wizard of Oz scene in a lot of ways, where, you know, Dorothy goes out to chase Toto and gets swept up in the tornado. And what happens is the boy is out trying to get the dog, and the first bombs hit in Kansas City, and he looks at the blast, and it blinds him. And he spends most of the rest of the movie with his eyes bandaged. And, you know, I saw this, and I was thinking about the movie and realized, of course, that character, the boy, was really a perfect metaphor for me and for a lot of kids, I think, in my generation, who were, many of us, I think, were sort of blind to kind of the implications or the reality of what was going on. And I started to imagine, I mean, one of the things I was trying to figure out in the book is, well, what is the legacy of this film? What is the impact for me today? How has it affected the way I am as a person, as a writer, as a father? And I started to imagine, like, well, what would it be like if it still was affecting me today? How would I be if I was the most extreme kind of reaction to the film possible? And that became this Danny Dahlberg character who, as an adult, lives in a bunker in Arizona and writes post-apocalyptic fiction and can't let the movie go, you know? And at first it was, I mean, I do a lot of kind of activities and exercises when I write, sometimes to have fun and kind of keep myself writing. And initially, I think that's what this was, and I was kind of playing around. And then, you know, I started going back and looking how I could sort of do more of that, and I started thinking of, you know, scenes that might have taken place outside of the film. And part of that is an effort to create in the book, or try to mimic in the book, the kind of blurring of fiction and nonfiction, which the film does, obviously, and intentionally. And that, I think, for me growing up in the 80s and with the movie, there was a lot of that, a lot of sort of blurring of the boundaries between what is real and what is fantasy or fabricated. And so, you know, the conceit, I guess, in the book is that the people in the movie are both in a movie but also sort of real. Mm-hmm. Which,
another twist on faction.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I love that term. Yeah, I think I should tell people that's what I teach. What do you teach and write? I teach faction.
You know, I was curious because I'm reading at the same time that I was reading your book. I'm also reading Bill McKibben's latest book, Earth. And Earth, which is E-A-A-R-T-H, is about how we already now live on an Earth that's different than the one we were born into. And, you know, I have to say, global warming, I think, is the apocalypse.
Yeah, it is.
That is really real. It is happening. It is going to profoundly impact even us in our own lifetime, as well as, of course, our children and grandchildren, assuming that the planet is still habitable enough for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder why you didn't talk about global warming in your book.
Well, I think, you know, I thought about it. And in fact, as I was, you know, working on the book, of course, a whole slew of movies, and kind of apocalyptic weather movies, of course, have come out the Day After Tomorrow, right, which is the most obvious one that's connected to the Day After. And I think really what I realized is that I could keep writing this book for the rest of my life, you know, because the apocalypse or the idea of it and what it means, it keeps changing. And as I was trying to show in the book, that it's always going to change. I'm not sure I'm ever going to fully understand what it means to sort of live in a world with this threat of apocalypse. And I guess one of the things I've discovered, or what I think after writing the book, is that it's just part of human nature to have these ideas and to sort of know at some level that this could happen, and that one of sort of the uniquely human struggles is to try to figure out how to prevent that thing, the apocalypse, whether it be a nuclear apocalypse or whether it be, you know, the kind of terrorist apocalyptic vision that was sold to us for quite a while, but which now has kind of, you know, faded a bit, and which is being, I think, replaced with this different sort of vision of apocalypse. And I guess I could keep going on this book, you know. Maybe I'll write another one about my kids and how they deal with it. And, you know, one of the things I'm interested in is, of course, what sorts of films are they going to be obsessed with?
Well, you know, I guess that was interesting to me, because it seems to me the climate apocalypse is the one that is the most real and the one least talked about, acknowledged, or recognized.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's a connection between those two things.
The most real and the least acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you're probably absolutely right about that. I mean, because I'm not sure why. Do you think we just, we don't like the thought that we could actually do something to change it? Or is it, you know, maybe it's the fact that what that face forces us to deal with is our own culpability. Mm. I mean, when it's the terrorists, or the Soviets, or, you know, the Russians, there's an enemy who's responsible, and we can blame them. Whereas with the global apocalypse, the message is, it's your fault. You have the power to change it right now, which is, you know, I think both liberating and encouraging and somewhat terrifying, probably, to a lot of people. I think that they both are responsible for it. Isn't it like that's the definition of angst, right? Realizing that your own radical freedom and the fact that you're always and every moment responsible for your potential demise.
I would think that it's also the profound sense of helplessness that we feel.
Yeah.
Because if we are to change it, we have to do it together.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love to think, I really do hope. I mean, I talk about in the book how Meyer, and this is in the context of 9/11 and terrorism, and he's suggesting that, you know, it's much worse now, and that he doesn't think a movie could have the same effect and could change the way people think or the way people could change policy. And I, of course, maybe I'm an optimist, but I want to believe that if not a movie, then art, at least on some level, can do that. You know, that if art can create hope, then maybe it can help, you know, make these changes. That's probably self-serving since I'm a writer. But
Well, the book is The Day After the Day After, My Atomic Angst. We've been talking with Stephen Church. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Stephen Church is also the author of The Guinness Book of Me and Theoretical Killings. He teaches writing at Fresno State and at the University of New Orleans. He's also founding editor of the literary magazine The Normal School. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.